our planet is a lonely speck in the great cosmic dark.
Hi, this is Chrissy.
And I'm Marie.
And you're listening to Alts Pop Repeat,
a show where we get into the nitty-gritty around counterculture, alternative culture, and sync it up with what?
With pop culture.
Yeah, man. That's what we do.
There we go.
High five. Yes. You want the quote?
I want it.
If you want to know how hip-hop is doing, then ask yourself, how am I doing? Where am I going? Most F.
That's
my quote.
That's your quote. No,
I love Mos Def. I think it's a great comment towards hip hop. That makes sense. If you're in the hip hop community and you like hip hop talks about what's going on in its own culture and the cultures around them. So it's a good, it's a good response. It's actually really smart for Mos Def. When I read that, I'm like,
that was really smart for Mos Def.
Yeah, well, he's super smart, but it's, what do you mean?
Why? Well, did you just diss Mos Def by accident?
No.
You're like, that was really smart for him.
No, I wasn't being sarcastic. Seriously, I think it's a really smart quote from him.
Yeah.
And he's, well, obviously he knows how to write. He's a poet. Most rappers are poets too, though.
Does he know it?
He does.
Yeah, it's a hip-hop. Welcome to the hip-hop show. It's a fun show. It's like, it's going to be pretty educational, I think. Hip hop is a pervasive medium that we listen to on a daily basis. It's pervaded in every single style of music that's consumed today in pop culture.
100%. It's one of the only countercultures, I would say, that besides cannabis, that has influenced mainstream pop culture the most is hip hop. Hip hop is everywhere. Hip hop is in everything. Every single thing of pop culture, hip hop has touched. Can I get an amen?
Amen. This is where you insert the sound of amen.
Amen.
And to lead us into the conversation, we are joined by one of the most influential, well, one of the members of the most influential hip hop outfit to come out in the 80s. And it's it is who?
Run DMC. An iconic trio, hip hop trio that started in 1983 and then really helped create the new genre during that time of new school hip hop.
Yeah.
We're not chatting about later 80s and MWA and Eazy-E and all of them because we wanted to stick within a specific genre. And honestly, he is one of the major sinks that moved hip hop into mainstream. So we'll get into that. And in the end,
we sync it up.
Bye bye. Run, you're out of cold whack, get the crowd full on. You're the kind of guy that girl ignored. I'm driving caddy, you fix the floor.
I'm just a kid from Queens, New York, who did some cool things because of what creativity allows a person to do. I'm no different from anybody, from any generation, anywhere in the world. I grew up in Queens, New York. I went to Catholic school my whole life. I was a straight A student, always on the honor roll. And I wasn't ashamed of it. I was a geeky, nerdy kid who thought being a geeky nerd was cool. And, you know, I was going through all the trials and tribulations that any young person in the world would be going through. You know, peer pressure, bullying. You know, I hate my parents because they don't let me do stuff. So, you know, I was just a normal kid. And most of the kids in my neighborhood were just normal kids trying to figure life out. So that being said, I guess I was a little different from the majority of kids because, you know, growing up in New York City at that time in the 70s, it was death, destruction, and darkness everywhere, especially in the Bronx, though. I lived in Queens. So, you know, we had a home. My father mowed the lawn. We had a backyard. The neighborhood that I lived in, what was beautiful about it was, it's different now. Now nobody cares about anybody. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's so selfish and so self-centered because, I don't know. But back then, your mother was my mother. My mother was your mother. There was a sense of community, you know, growing up. But the neighborhood that we lived in, you would have to leave. I lived on 197th Street. So you would have to go up Hollis, up the avenue, to see the pimps and the pushers and the drug dealers and the gangbangers. Now, the kids in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, the kids in Harlem at that time, they walked out their apartment buildings and all of that was right there. So for us, we was in a suburban, lower middle class neighborhood. So the only time you would see the riffraff is when you walked up on the avenue. You know what I'm saying? So if you walked up on Hollis Avenue, everything that all the kids who lived in the inner city of New York City experienced, we would experience that. But it was a little different for me because, you know, I wasn't in a gang. I wasn't selling drugs. I wasn't, you know, robbing houses. You know, we was not in the majority of the kids was in the street gangs.
Right.
But there was a small little circle that wasn't. And the only thing that allowed us to exist in our world and survive was our imagination. What was remarkable about that was the kids in the Bronx, who the Bronx was burning in the 70s. It was a war zone. All the buildings was burnt down. It was hell. And even in Harlem, Harlem's different now. If you go to Harlem now, it's not Harlem, it's Harlem. It's been a renaissance of businesses and restaurants and the whole neighborhood. It's just beautiful in Harlem. But back in the 70s, it was hell up in Harlem. So it was remarkable that this style of music came over the bridge because it wasn't no radio. Hip hop wasn't on a radio.
Totally.
There was no MTV. The only way you heard hip hop was by cassette tapes.
The mixtape.
People would record that and they would go from the Bronx and Manhattan to every other borough. So remarkably, you know, this style of music came over the bridge that gave creative, imaginative kids with imagination and ideas a way to express themselves.
I was going to ask you quickly, I'm like, was that the time that you were Easy D at that point? Because way before Run DMC,
Easy D started once I started hearing the tapes. But you got to understand, I was still young. You know what I'm saying? I'm 12 years old. And music is not important to me. What's important to me is comic books, riding my bike. The whole hip hop thing wasn't showbiz for a lot of people at first. You can tell stories about who you are over music to express yourself. So I just started writing rhymes for me, not for anybody else to hear. It was for me alone. I would write the rhyme and say it to myself.
Do you remember one of the first rhymes that you wrote?
Yeah, one of the first rhymes I wrote was about how we used to go down to Jamaica Avenue was where you would go to get your jewelry and your cologne and your sneakers. The parents would take you school shopping to Jamaica Avenue. So one of the first rhymes I wrote was, I like going out on sunny days, go down to the Ave to check out Mays. Mays was like Macy's. It was a department store called Mays. At the cheapest spots, I make stops. I buy British Walkers, which was a shoe from a store called Revel Knox. And one of the things that was signature, the bus that we took to Jamaica Avenue was the Q2.
Right.
So I would say I take the bus that they call the two. They are green and white and sometimes blue. Because back then the colors for mass transit buses was blue. So it was about this little kid's journey down to Jamaica Avenue to go school shopping. I like going out on sunny days, go down to the Ave to check out Mays at the cheapest spots. I make stops. I buy British Walkers from Revel Knox. I take the bus that they call the two. They are green and white and sometimes blue. That's what hip hop was for me per se. But once the tape started coming in, that made me realize it was always in front of my eyes, but I never noticed it. It wasn't until the tapes from the Bronx started coming in that I started noticing the DJs and the kids rapping in the parks and in the block parties.
I'm assuming, and from what I've read about you, that you spent time in Two Fifths Parks in Hollis. Like, right. What can you explain to us what that felt like? You would go down and right. You know, there would be from rap battles, local DJs,
right.
And take us through like those memories and going down and like, yeah. How did people react? Was there like a hierarchy of DJs that you kind of had to perform for so that you could move to another level? Like, what was that like?
You know, well, what had happened was once the DJs and the rappers in the Bronx, now this is before rap records, this had nothing to do with the music. Once those DJs got known, Grandmaster Flash, Grand Wizard Theodore, Charlie Chase and Tony Tone, DJ Easy Lee, Grand Wizard Theodore, Cool Herc. Once all the DJs who invented the thing started getting famous by these tapes going around, everybody in all the other boroughs wanted to be like them. So the scene was everybody wanted to take their music to the park. And the park was basically throwing a concert in the middle of a neighborhood without permission from the law enforcement, without notifying the governor and the mayor. So these DJs would put on concerts in the local park. And like 2,000, 3,000 people would show up and they would play these records and tell the police. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
They would play the records until the police would come and pull the plug and send us home. The cops would come and say, "You guys can't have a concert in the neighborhood. Pull the plug, you young people take your butts home." So we would go home, and then the next day we would come right back. But the what people don't realize is hip-hop, I'm talking about the DJs performing, it was just a byproduct of what the discos were doing. Hip-hop is a cousin of disco, because if you look at New York City in the 70s, people thought New York City was heaven. Until hip-hop pulled the veil from in front of people's eyes, it was Studio 54. But that wasn't true, because in the streets of New York City, the schools was messed up, crime was everywhere. People didn't know the reality of what New York was really like. But they thought it was really, they thought it was better than Hollywood because of what they saw with Studio 54. But when we saw the images of Studio 54, we didn't see the richness of it. It was so bad for the young people in New York that we saw, wow, they get together and play music and everybody's happy. So we said, we're going to do that. So we took the DJ equipment, turntables and music and speakers, and we put it in the neighborhood so that for 2 or 3 hours a day in the summer, we could have goodness, because there was nothing goodness. The plug would get pulled, and then it'll be back to death, destruction, and darkness. But there was a beauty of these young kids setting up these big sound systems and playing not only music that we was rapping to, but we was playing music that we grew up listening to, our mother and fathers listening to. We was playing Al Green and James Brown and Aretha Franklin. So there was something that was generationally impactful about that. At first, the grown-ups hated us because the music was so loud. But the minute we throw on a James Brown record, the grown-ups stopped calling the police on us because it brought them back to when they was young people. So it was a thing where we was just trying, the whole idea was hip-hop, was just trying to make 2 hours of your day nice. And which that was the whole main motivation about it.
Talking about DJ Cool Herc and how he was instrumental, he created The Break. Yes, he was born in Jamaica, but at 10 years old, he was in New York. So there was a lot of like James Brown and all this influential music.
Yep, his music was the foundation that hip-hop was built on. You know, because it was out of struggle, you know, James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black, I'm Proud. Not only James Brown, too, a lot of the famous people at that time took their celebrity and used it to address the issues that was affecting the people in the audience. James Brown's did it. Even Marvin Gaye, who was known for sexy love songs, he did What's Going On.
Yeah.
When you look at John Lennon, what he did to protest the war and injustices he saw, John Fogerty, you know, John Fogerty did Fortunate Son, Neil Young, who did Ohio, about the shooting of the students at Kent University. So all the people's music that we were using, see, it's different now. Nowadays, the younger generation don't care about who did what for a thing to exist. We sampled and used all this music, but we would stop and we would read up on these people. So we knew John Lennon was, you know, one of the guys from the Beatles, but then we was inspired because we was like, yo, this guy slept naked in a bed to protest the war. Like, we thought that was gangster. We was like, yo, the rock stars and the superstars of music are calling out our government.
Yes.
So that was another thing that inspired the attitude of hip hop. But like you said, James Brown always had a funky drummer beat for us to run our mouths. And basically what we did, we took every hip hop of Grandmaster Caz of the legendary Cold Crush Brothers said hip hop didn't really invent anything. We reinvented everything. We was taking everybody's music that impacted the generation before us, and we was finding a little space where nobody was talking so we could tell our stories. And that was the whole thing. Okay, we're going to bring some goodness to the parks through this music, and now I'm able to tell you who I am. Prior to that, there was no other way to do that. But you got to understand, we didn't just do it with the music. See, people think hip-hop is a genre of music. No, it's a culture. It's a lifestyle.
When we look at that, for example, even Adidas, you guys, you were 100% the ones to bring clothing and yep. everything else into the forefront. If it wasn't for Run DMC, yep. Adidas would never get the play and the culture that it did. You merged those two together.
Yep.
Yeah, like what was that? Because I know that, like, you know, back to the disco, which I think is ironic that, you were saying that. And the disc, I think it was Disco Fever you guys got booed in your first
performance. Yeah.
And then that was that moment that I read that you guys kind of decided to switch up your style.
Yeah,
like, can you explain? Say, yeah. Yeah. Why? Yeah.
Well, we didn't want to be alienated from our audience. Showbiz, this is important. Anything that is sacred to a culture or a people will get diluted, polluted, and destroyed once it's commercialized. I don't care what it is. You know what I'm saying? Because the people who are commercializing it, number one, they don't care about the people, they don't care about the spirit, and they don't care about the purpose. They just saw, yo, we can make money. So for us, when we saw that about to happen, see, the reason why Run DMC was able to do the biggest things in hip hop that everybody else did, not just sell records, I'm talking about change the world, was because we valued the purpose and the result with the purpose. So for us, the first rappers though, everybody before Run DMC, Curtis Blow, Grandmaster Flash, Afrika Bambaataa, and Soul Sonic Force, that's why I said I'm not a legend. Those guys are legends because the first rappers and DJs had no rappers and DJs to look up to because they were the first. So when they got in show business, if you look at Grandmaster Flash, they look like the Rolling Stones, or they look like Sid Vicious. They look like the punk groups. If you look at Afrika Bambaataa and the Zulu Nation who did Planet Rock, if you look at that album cover, they look exactly like Parliament Funkadelic. That's who their idols was for show business. But growing up in the streets, hip-hop is come as you are, like Nirvana said, come as you are. So we changed our style because we didn't want our audience to think we was above them or better than them. So when you saw Run DMC with the Adidas and me with the glasses on and us with the angles and hats, you didn't see celebrity. See, celebrity ruins everything. You saw yourself. And when those people saw that, you know, when three white Jewish kids from Manhattan saw us, they became the Beastie Boys. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? When three young kids from Long Island saw us, they became De La Soul. You know, when three Latinos from LA's, you know what I'm saying, Bowery area saw us, they became Cypress Hill. So when people saw Run DMC, they realized you don't have to switch who you are to participate in the entertainment business.
Yeah, and then Rockbox being the first music video, like rap music video on MTV ever. That is that transition of taking like hip hop culture and rap as the music from it and really pushing those lines. And I would say that's why we call you a legend. And I would say because if it wasn't for those moments of MTV and pushing boundaries and also VH1, like not playing rap music
at all
and then deciding to, like you really, and like Run DMC in general were really that catalyst, one of those first catalysts to ever break through to pop culture. And so that everyone could see that rap was what rap was about and how it was so versatile.
And it was relatable. Like when we did Rock Box was just us attempting to put rock and rap together to show that black people and white people aren't really different. So when we did Rock Box, all the black kids who was ashamed to say that they listened to Black Sabbath could now take off the shirt they was hiding their Black Sabbath under and be proud about it. And vice versa, all the white kids, you know, all of Travis Barker, Blink 182, Nirvana, you know, David Grohl was like, yo, when y'all came out that way, we never missed the Run DMC and Beastie Boys show. These kids were listening to black music. And the black kids was listening to white music, but everything was so separated and segregated, you know what I'm saying, for people's personal reasons that when we came with Rock Box, everybody could just look at it as music. So then that was 84. Then in 85, we did a song. We had the balls to call ourselves the Kings of Rock. And we did rock. We did King of Rock with Larry Bud Melman from the David Letterman show, standing in front of a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame museum denying us entry. Now, you know what's crazy about that video? I'm the King of Rock. There is none higher. Sucker MCs should call me Sire, and getting denied entry into a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame museum. When we did that video, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame didn't even exist. So we was doing all this prophetic stuff. And the reason why I make that so prominent in what I'm speaking about is it wasn't about us saying, yo, we're going to do music to get money. If you do something that is going to be good, if you're going to do something that is has a purpose, the money will come. But it's greater to do something that's going to impact people's lives. Like I said, our only motivation was to make people feel good. So we became the ones in hip hop so good at making people feel good. Now they want to give us money to come do the thing that we was doing for free anyway. So in 85, we did the King of Rock. And then 86, we took on another step by actually doing a rock song with the rock band, doing one of their records over when we hooked up with Aerosmith.
Yes.
And then it was off to the stratosphere for them. But the beautiful thing about that video too was everywhere I go globally, people say, yo, when Steven Tyler took that mic stand in the video and knocked down the wall that was separating us, they say that didn't just happen in the video, it happened in the world. And it gave birth to something group, it gave birth to something beautiful. But now that being said, all of these things is already being done. Like I can't understand why the same problems exist in any government for 500 years, because it's always the creatives, the writers, the journalists, the storytellers, the actors, the poets, and we have the solutions, but it seems like the powers that be don't want to pay attention to that. Like what Run DMC did with Aerosmith wasn't something new, because B.B. King was always playing with Eric Clapton. You know, the Rolling Stones was always going to Muddy Water shows and Howlin' Wolf shows and respecting the blues. So black people and white people played together. Clarence Clemens was in Bruce Springsteen's band. Artists, writers, creators, painters, sculptors, we have heaven on earth. Nobody want to utilize that. So for Run DMC, we think we were just doing some cool hip hop thing, but at the same time, by showing up in a video on MTV with Aerosmith, that's going to have it's going to have an impact when that video gets in every living room globally. Yo, what is Run DMC doing with Aerosmith? And then Aerosmith fans is going to go, what is Aerosmith doing with Run DMC? And then they're going to see that when together, that's the thing that changed. And like you said earlier, allow all of this to explode.
You told us like the beautiful story of your childhood and how it was idyllic in so many ways in comparison to all the other things that were happening.
Yeah, it was Christmas time in Hollis, Queens every day.
It was Christmas time in Hollis, Queens. Yeah. And so I was curious, like, when you guys were hitting the air, I was young, not to brag, but
right,
you know, just if there's any potential suitors that might be listening, I just want to let them know. But as you're going through it, you guys were the first rap act to be on MTV. That's a huge thing. Like, how did that happen?
People forget. There's always some black and white stuff. What had happened was MTV started getting flack for not playing a lot of more black artists. There's an infamous David Bowie interview. This is like a legendary story. David Bowie, in the middle of his interview, they asked him David Bowie questions about him, and he just stopped and he said, "Why don't y'all play more black people on MTV?" And MTV was like, you know, and at the time they started playing Michael Jackson with Beat It, you know what I'm saying? But they wasn't playing all of these other people. So I guess what happened was, see, it's funny. Let me say it like this. They wasn't going to play The Message. Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on us. It was the truth about New York City. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. They wasn't going to play that. They should have. They should have played that. But when Run DMC came along with these black dudes rapping over rock music, it was like a savior for them. So I don't think it was all about Run DMC. It was something that they could throw out there to, it was like PR control. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But the fact that we had rock and rap together, whatever MTV's motivations behind it was, the fact that we did that, it allowed us to change the whole way people perceived what was going on. You know what I'm saying? It was these black kids rapping over this white rock band's music. But the fact that MTV at a time when it was getting criticized for not playing enough black artists, to be able to play a style of music from the black in a city, not only it was good PR for them, but it was groundbreaking.
Can we segue, Daryl, into like now new hip hop? Because we have this term of like you guys, like new hip hop to old hip hop, but now we have like new hip hop.
Right.
So we have people like but Joey also, Badass.
Classic rock doesn't mean old. Classic means better than everything that comes after it for eternity. So old school doesn't mean an old style of music. Old school is a consciousness of how you artistically and creatively and innovatively present who you are.
Right.
So if you listen to these old school records and listen to the stuff now, not even comparing it from generation point, you're guaranteed to listen to old school for the rest of your life because it's eternal. Because we put subjects and content that you're going to relate to. The majority of hip hop in the last 10 years is stuff that the people who are engaging it now, when they get 25, 26, 27, they're not going to listen to that no more. Why? Because they're going to have bills to pay. They're going to have marital problems. They're going to have to gut. You know what I'm saying? We made music. See, people, the music that we made when we was 12 to 25 years old was music that seems like we could have wrote it when we was 40 to 80. See, that's what people don't get. The old school, we were young kids rhyming about government, politics, history, and social issues at the same time while we was having fun. So the music now, and that's because of the commercialization of music. There's great songs that come out and you only hear about it for 2 weeks and then you don't hear about it no more. Also, it's a thing where people nowadays don't care about the history of anything. You know what I'm saying? Like, we cared about the history. You know what I'm saying? The reason why we was able to do what we've done with this hip-hop thing is because we knew why Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa and Flash did it in the first place. Yes, we want to get money. Yes, you want the new house and stuff like that. But the new house and money ain't going to be here 100 years from now. What's got to be here now is the spirit, right? It's the spirit. It's like, that's what we want to teach the kids. You can make the record like, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier. After you go out to the club and party, you got to wake up the next morning. So a lot of these artists, there's some that do it, deal with the emotional and the mental states of us and the social states. But most of the music that's successful is cussing people out and having a good time. But good times don't last forever. You got to keep recreating good times. But Run DMC and all the pioneers before us did, we created something that will be here forever. So in the midst of being whatever kind of artist you are, like if you look at The Message was a gangster rap record, but it was done with integrity. You know what I'm saying? Broken. I'm like a jungle. Melly Mel and them could have said, we shoot and we stab and we kill and sell drugs, but they didn't say that. They talked about how all, not just the young people, they talked about how, the message was about how my mother and father felt waking up every day. You know what I'm saying? So there's a responsibility. I mean, it's cliche. There's a responsibility with the artist that a lot of pop successful so-called celebrities refuse to step up to. So that determines if you as gangster as you say you are. You know what I'm saying? Okay, you got money. Okay, you sold a lot of records. You're number one on Billboard. But what are you doing every day with that gift? Now, truth be told, to each his own now. You know, you don't have to do it. But if you choose to do it, then you have the essence of what hip-hop is. Hip-hop is, you know, when somebody's rapping over a tape performing, that's not hip-hop. That's somebody rap. Real hip-hop is a DJ playing vinyl records while the rapper raps. Yeah. That's hip-hop.
So what did you think then when Suge Knight and like Tupac, like this is going back, like when Suge Knight started to bring in a lot more of that thug element and that gangster element and the street element back into the music, well, like, what did you think then when that started happening? Because it was opposite of what you guys were doing.
Well, once NWA came out for the music business, it established another genre that could be exploited. You know, I put it like this. Like Ice-T always said, sex and violence sells. How are you going to get somebody to pay attention to the guy that's not shooting a gun? So that was the purpose of hip-hop, to talk about the gun, but then the very next record to say, don't use it. To say, we understand there's gangs. There's always going to be gangs and crime. Don't get mad at him for being in a gang. Give him some other information to show that he doesn't have to be in it. So for that whole era of the 90s, that was just the music business profiting off what NWA established. Oh, people is going to buy this. You know, before you would have to do it, those records wouldn't be played in the mainstream. Prior to that, gangster rap was underground. You had to be 21 and older to hear it. You had to be 21 and older to know where to get it from. And even the artists who made their music, when they went on stage, they would do a clean version of it.
Yeah.
But then it got to the point where the record companies realized, yo, Pop, don't do your clean version, do the dirty version, because more people going to show up to see it. So that whole area of the 90s, everything that was positive got overlooked because it didn't sell it. It didn't sell as much. You only have to spend $500,000 to promote gangster rap. You might have to spend $3 million to promote something positive. But putting the $3 million to promote something positive is way more worth it than you get a better impact on life than what that gangster rap record would sell. And that was the difference. Run DMC, especially me, I knew that if I rhyme about me wearing glasses the same way a guy would rhyme about selling drugs, I could change some people's lives.
Right.
It's amazing.
You know what I'm saying? DMC in the place to be. D's for doing it all of the time. M's for the rhymes that are mine. C's for cool as can be. And Run would ask me, why you wear those glasses? I would go, so I can see. And I would fold my arms like this. Now, people that don't even want to wear glasses want to wear glasses because of DMC, not to be like me, because they know they could do something good. As opposed to me rhyming, I sell drugs and I got a big gun. If I did that, people who like me would say, DMC said it's cool to know. I understand why people sell drugs, but you don't have to.
So where do you see the music now? Like when we look at counterculture in hip hop now, like what's that underground sound that you're hearing that's different from trap, that's different from, you know, hip hop and rap that's out now? Yeah. Like is there anything that you hear and what is trickling that's going to become mainstream? What do you think is going to break?
There's an underground sound right now where people talking about, number one, the social conditions that exist in this planet now. Like music always evolves and it always, you know, shifts and shapes. Like hip hop now is so disrespectful to women. They, as opposed to telling stories about the use of drugs, they glorify the use of drugs. Almost every record has to drop the F-bomb and the bitch and the whole word to be cool. And people say, man, I don't like today's hip hop, but they continue to allow the record companies to put the records out the way that they do. I'm not saying don't put them out. This isn't about censorship and freedom of speech. It's about calling something that is not good, not good. People are afraid to say something is not good because they're so worried about how the world will look at them.
Just to reflect on the interview for a hot moment,
yeah,
before we segue into like the sink, but it's really surreal to have a conversation with somebody who literally was the first hip hop act to be played on MTV.
Yeah.
Run DMC introduced an entire generation to hip hop and changed music forever. And there, I mean, without Run DMC, there wouldn't have been my personal favorite, Beastie Boys.
For sure. But that whole time was called New School Hip Hop. But New School Hip Hop was characterized with a form of drum machine and minimalism, and then had elements of rock. And Run DMC was that catalyst that moved hip hop into rock. Unbelievable. Like, Daryl is for sure one of the most iconic people I probably talked to ever.
Next to me.
Next to yourself.
Right? But yeah, like legitimately.
I get to see you all the time.
I know, exactly. You forget that you're talking to a legend. Yeah. Here's the thing. Music has always been instrumental in inspiring rebellion and change, societal change. Always. Rock and roll did it. Where they were taking influences of African-American music and bringing it into music, talking about sexuality, talking about rebellion, sharing this idea of racial integration and freedom of thought that didn't exist before. That was rock and roll did. Every other major medium during that time, television and film, were really trying to push those traditional, like, religious societal norms that they just wanted to hold on to. But music has always changed it. So once we got into this world of hip hop, it was transformative because, again, because Run DMC is the first sync for hip hop in mainstream. In mainstream. I mean, there's other people that were instrumental in it. There's
for sure.
Obviously DJ Herc, et cetera, that were instrumental to develop the form. It was Run DMC that brought it into the mainstream. And
MTV did help that with Rockbox. Rockbox was the first DMC single that went, it was the first hip hop music video ever played on MTV. Yeah, but when they're watching MTV, they're watching a lot of rock and they're watching, let's say, punk or things like that. They're not watching hip hop.
No.
And so when you get the first video that is Rockbox on there, you're getting a mix of hip hop and rock together. So that's the first time that's been ever done. And also then on mainstream TV.
Yeah.
So you're getting a whole new collective of people being introduced to a new genre.
Yes. It was introduced to a new genre. And it was about time. Like David Bowie said, why are you not playing more black artists? It was this time where I think that the prevalence of white decision makers in mainstream media and mainstream entertainment products like music just kind of took for granted their power and their privilege, assuming, of course, that the mainstream only wanted to listen to the David Bowies, like the mainstream pop, like the Elton Johns, and that they didn't think that the mainstream wanted to listen to hip hop. But like rock music back in the 50s, where, you know, the mainstream music makers, music decision makers didn't think that African motifs in music were going to have mainstream appeal. The same thing could have been said in the 80s, and why it took so long for hip hop to make the jump. Because in the 83, correct?
Was 83. When 83 and 84 was the time when it was the new school of hip hop.
And it started, but hip hop, like as a movement, it was starting in the 70s.
Yeah, Sugar Hill Gang did Rapper's Delight, and that was 1979. So just before Run DMC dropped Rockbox and a lot of other music that came out during that time. Because Run DMC started in 83, I believe.
But even before, you got to go, like, we got to go Sugar Hill Gang. Yep. And there's wouldn't have happened if Kool Herc
yep.
hadn't brought in the influences that he had from Jamaican sound systems. He pioneered the use of DJing as percussion. Again, isolating the break. If he didn't do that and he didn't revolutionize isolating the break in the song and using DJ equipment as, you know, DJing as percussive, then we wouldn't have had this foundation of a new sound that eventually would turn into hip hop as we know it.
For sure. And you have artists like Big Daddy Kane as well, too. Really mm-hmm. instrumental to the hip hop movement.
So. Yeah. And like hip hop, like, okay, let's do some foundational knowledge on hip hop. So hip hop.
Shoot.
Obviously, it started in the 70s. DJ Kool Herc brought it together. Now, there's five main pieces to hip hop.
Yeah, there's the elements of hip hop.
Yeah, and this is hip hop culture, right? So
rap is part of hip hop culture.
Correct.
Right.
So hip hop,
the music of hip hop,
is a counterculture. And then the subculture, the subgenre of that would be like these five pieces, right? Now you're learning with us. So counterculture, hip hop.
Yeah.
Right. Subculture, subgenre, rap is one.
Yep. B-boying.
B-boying.
Beatboxing.
MCing, DJing, breaking, graffiti.
And trapping. It's ever evolving, right? So it used to be the four elements of hip hop, and then it's five, and now people are saying that there's seven. So I would say there's seven. I'll go with the latter on that one. So B-boying, beatboxing, DJing, graffiti, MCing. Trapping. The big thing, though, that started in the new school hip hop movement was really about having an MC with someone that was DJing, because that's a big part of that. And in the new school hip hop movement, that's what they had, and that's what Run DMC was doing.
So we've got our five elements of it. We know where it came from. Where should we go on our journey now?
Well, I say we go into fashion. We're going to stick with the 80s.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Okay, yeah. Cool.
So we know that we go back to Run DMC. So they were the first group ever to do a deal with a major fashion brand. And that was Adidas, because they had the song, My Adidas. I'm going to throw to a clip right now where Run DMC is talking about My Adidas and how this all started. And they talk about how Adidas was iconic to them.
Word up. And we always rock our Adidas on our feet with no shoestrings in them. I did not win them. I bought them off the app with the Levi denim. I like to sport them. That's why I brought them. A sucker tried to steal them. So I caught them and I fought them. Then I walked down the street and bop to the beat with Lee on my leg and Adidas on my feet. And yo, now I'm just standing here shooting the gift. Me and D and my Adidas standing on 2/5. My Adidas.
Yeah, we just like to wear Adidas because this is what we always wore, you know what I'm saying? We don't want to change up. Everybody was starting to buy Fila and Reeboks
and New Balance.
And New Balance.
And Puma.
And we seen that Adidas was going down. Everybody was saying, hey, why y'all not getting on New Balance now? Why y'all not wearing Reeboks? Why y'all not wearing Fila? And we said,
ain't nothing changed.
You gonna wear Adidas because that's what we always
wear. They got all the colors and all the styles, black and white, white with black stripe.
The ones I like to wear when I rock the mic.
So that show was done in 1986. After Adidas ended up seeing that show, they ended up then and listening to the song My Adidas. And then at that show at Madison Square Garden, Run DMC asked them to hold the crowd to hold up their sneakers. So obviously after Adidas hears this, they're going to freak out, and they offer them an endorsement deal. The first time ever done with any brand, any celebrity, the only endorsement deals that any sports brand would ever do is generally with athletes. This is the first time it was ever done in history, and they signed a $1 million endorsement deal, which is huge back in 1986. So like huge. Times by 10 now? Like, I don't even know what that would be in equivalent to today.
Run DMC also was bringing into it the characteristic fashion style that we associate. The Adidas shoes, gold
the jumpsuits.
Do you know what those are called?
What?
Dookie chains.
Dookie chains. So why is it called that?
That is not something I can find an accurate answer on. But I can tell
you. But you can tell me.
But I can tell you what it was representational of. So the gold rope was representational of street cred.
Oh, right? Okay, cool.
So it was, cool. This was an incredibly influential part of the uniform. So if you were a hip hop artist, you were Fresh Prince, DJ Jazzy Jeff, you're Biz Markie, you were wearing the gold chain. And it was a representation of street cred and a rival. So Jam Master Jay incorporated the Dookie role in his wardrobe before he became a part of Run DMC.
Cool.
Yeah. So when he did join up with his future band, he gave Run and DMC their own chains as a symbol, proving that they were official in the hip hop game.
That's cool.
So it was like a whole symbolic thing. And the concept is still a part of the whole culture.
When I was looking up other things, one of them that I found was novelty rap songs in commercials, right? Get ready. I know I did the same thing. Marie's face was like, what?
Novelty rap songs?
Novelty rap songs.
From who? For what?
Yeah. So there was commercials. No shit. 1983, comedian Rodney Dangerfield took a stab with Rodney rapping.
Oh, yeah. No.
So it doesn't mean that this turned out well. And these are not positive or good examples. Popular culture did it wrong this time. So we're going to insert another clip because I love my clip eclipse.
I need to hear
Rodney
this.
Dangerfield doing his rapping Rodney.
I tell you, I'm all right now, but last week I was in rough shape. Well, I don't get a break with nothing. I played hide and seek when I was three.
No respect, no respect.
Why they wouldn't even look for me?
No respect, no respect.
I was an ugly kid. I never had fun.
No respect, no respect.
Everyone felt entitled to it. Like, that's the thing. This is a cultural product. This is an African-American, Jamaican-American, Black American cultural product.
Oh, totally.
And then as
pop culture did not do hip hop well.
It did
this.
Not
they
do
tried.
Right.
I don't think that they were trying to appropriate the culture in any form. I don't think Rodney Dangerfield was. I love Rodney Dangerfield. I think he's hilarious. I don't think he was. I just think that there wasn't a lot of education around hip hop because it was something new for them as well, too, that was getting into the mainstream. So they thought, hey, let's be cool because hip hop is cool and let's do novelty rap songs.
But that's the joke, right? Like, that's
the
joke.
Now when you look at it, you're like, God, that's horrible.
You know what, white people? Sometimes we don't need to take this.
No, not everything needs to be a jingle.
Like, not everything needs to be jingled. Not everything needs to be like, we don't always have entitlement to everything. Like, just chill for a little bit, you know, Rodney Dangerfield. Okay, so I'm going to take your Rodney. And let's go down this path on, this is not, I would say this is not
you're
a
gonna raise
sink,
me?
But this you're is
raise me a sink?
A gross misuse
okay.
of the cultural product. This is a Wendy's training video from the 80s.
What?
Yeah, this is from 1989. This was a video that somehow found its way to the internet and it went viral because it's absolutely ridiculous. So one of them is called Grill Skills.
Grill Skills.
Let's see grill skills.
Now working the grill, Bill, it ain't so tough. But first of all, you got to check your stuff. Like a grill that's set at 250 with the meat and cheese that's ready to go. A towel to keep your station looking cool. But most of all, you got to have your tool.
But it's ridiculous. Like, this goes on for a total of 9 minutes.
Here's one thing, though. I will say, though, that because of things like Rodney Dangerfield and Mr. T doing these crossover videos, it was the first time that it opened up the floodgates for crossovers within popular culture. Doesn't mean that they were doing it right, but at least it started.
Hip hop as like those tools and those methods to get hip hop out there. I mean, before MTV even heard it, and probably like at some point, there's a piece of the story that's like, how did MTV legitimately hear about Run DMC? Like, how did that connection happen? And I like to think that it came from, and you mentioned it, the mixtape.
Yeah, and the mixtape started in the 70s. And it was done, started in the 70s. It appeared in the 70s in New York City. And some of the first artists to do it was African Bambaataa was one of them. And then it moved into the 1980s. And then DJs such as Brucey B, and then along with Kid Capri, started recording their live performances and then selling them on the street. And then that became the real first mixtapes. But where do we see mixtapes now, Marie? Like, you know this sync so well.
Well, I would say like mix. Thank you.
I do.
Mixtapes, I think now we see it as playlists. Like they don't, because mixtapes, even in Toronto, we've talked about this before, you still have one of the mixtapes that was going around Toronto for a while from 93.5 Flow FM, which is the first black owned radio station. This is a little bit later, but I mean, it was still a culture.
Yeah. That, it's kind of a mixtape. It's a mix CD.
It's still a mix.
It was a form of a mixtape that came from a commercialized radio station that was pushing hip hop, which is awesome. And I love it. And it was really the first time that you heard Toronto hip hop music and rap artists all in one place, and you could find them. And a couple of my friends were on it too. And that was actually first Drake's first song was actually on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. On that. You know what I'll do is I'll take a picture of it and I'll post it on our Instagram.
We should try and create
All Pop Repeat.
Pop. We should go to allpoprepeat.com and see the picture of it. And I think we should try and recreate that on Spotify if we can.
Totally.
Like put it together so you can listen to one of the original Flow mixtapes. Yeah. They still are going around. Playlists are still happening because at the time, like you have to think about it in terms of like culturally, how and what were people listening to? Hip hop was not considered a legitimate cultural product. So for it to get out to people, to get it to the DJs who were on the radio, to get in the hands of music producers that could create a career for a young artist, they had to be inventive. So they created like legitimately like these dope mixtapes, these demo tapes that featured their musics of their peers, and just handed them out, traded them, sold them.
Exactly. And that's how you end up getting on the radio too. And it used to be like that. It still was like that for the longest time, even in the 90s and 2000s, there was still that mixtape vibe. But if you wanted to get your stuff played, you would give it to a DJ, would pick up a mixtape and a DJ would play it in a club, and you'd be dancing in the club and you would hear a track and you would love it. And then you find out what mixtape it was from, or you found out who the artist was. And that's how it became popular. Mixtapes were $20 a pop. Mixtapes now are dying, unfortunately, and hopefully it will come back. But I think you're right that it's turned into now playlists.
It's playlists. I mean, not all mixtapes were sold because they had one function, which was to be a publicity driver, and it was multiple artists and it was self-produced. And so some of them, they'd give them away, they trade them. Now the way that we see those mixtapes manifest is if you are on Spotify, which is that's the streaming service that I subscribe to. On Spotify, you get your release radar. So every Friday, there is a custom compilation playlist that's put together with new artists that sound like other artists that I like to listen to, as well as new songs from artists that I love and follow. And that is how I discover new music for the most part. I think that mixtapes and, you know, going and turning on Much Music or MTV and listening to new music, like in the 80s, MTV was instrumental to introducing new people to new music, as much as radio was instrumental in introducing new music to new people.
For sure.
As was going to the club, and the DJs there were introducing people to new music. That we don't have that anymore. There is no 24-hour music station. It's all streaming. It's all YouTube. And unfortunately, these algorithms are dominating the platform. So if you listen to Run DMC, the chances are, if you only listen to Run DMC and you only seek out Run DMC on Spotify, then chances are Spotify is going to serve you every other rapper or hip hop artist that sounds similar. So you'll probably get a lot of Beastie Boys, and you'll get some other things mixed in there too. So you might not necessarily discover new diverse sounds. I rely on my release radar, but how is it getting on the radio? I don't know how the system works anymore.
I can tell you how you get on the radio.
Yeah.
I'm a music publicist.
Oh my God, is that what you do?
Really?
Chris?
I'm a publicist of multiple things, but music's one of them. You work with a radio servicer. So how it works now is that you have a track, or you have a single, or you have an EP, which is, you know, if you want to say it's a mixtape or not, but that's other terms that we can use. But you have an EP and you push one single to the radio, and you have a radio servicer, and that radio servicer then goes to the program director or the music director and pitches them why that single fits the tempo or fits the genre, if it's hot AC or if it's AC, adult contemporary or hot adult contemporary. And if it fits the tempo of the station and there's a lot of other notoriety around the artist. There doesn't have to be tons of it, but if there is notoriety around the artist, then the program director or the music director will pick up the song and put the track into rotation, and then they spin the track, and then the track will be in low, medium to high rotation. So that's how you get a single played on the radio.
That is like the most corporate sounding method.
I mean, like, that's what it is now. But back in the day, your mixtape was doing that for you. Like Most Def said, if you want to know what hip hop is doing, then ask yourself, how am I doing and where am I going? Love you, Most Def. Should we end the show now?
We should probably end the show now. With, I think we should end the show with some breaks.